We have two opening presentations to follow. The first is going to be by David Evans, and he's going to speak about the economics of multi-sided platforms. David is the chairman of the Global Economics Group at the firm's Boston office. Following David will be a presentation by Catherine Tucker, and she's going to speak about network effects in multi-sided platforms. Catherine is the Sloan Distinguished Professor of Management Science and Professor of Marketing at the Sloan School at MIT. David?
So thank you, Commissioner Chopra, for that nice set of remarks. It was a really good opening act for me. So what I was asked to do today, and thank you all very much for asking me to come to this. I guess I need to speak in front of this microphone here. Is that the deal? I can't move around, so I need to stay here. Okay. So I was asked to give a very basic introduction to multi-sided platforms, so that's what I'm going to do for the next 30 minutes. So let me start out with BlaBlaCar. So if you happen to be stuck in Paris and you want to take a nice trip to Barcelona, you could use BlaBlaCar to do that. It's a ride-sharing company, and they match up drivers and passengers, and they try to do that in a way so that it's a pleasant trip. That's a 10-hour drive from Paris to Barcelona, so you kind of want to be in the car with people you like. In order to get you matched up, they need to have a nice density of drivers and passengers between those city pairs, so they kind of need that in order to make the thing work. They have an interesting pricing model, so you can't be a professional driver, really, for BlaBlaCar. What they do is they cap the fee for the driver at basically the cost of gas plus a little bit of depreciation. I was in Australia for all of last week, so I've had to switch back from, say, petrol to gas. And then finally, you know, one of the nice things about this is it increases both driver and passenger welfare, and we know that because we see those smiling faces right in the middle of the screen there. So that's an example of a platform, and there's an increasing number of these, as we know, just sort of in our daily lives. From the minute we wake up in the morning until the time we go to bed, whether it's in our personal lives or whether it's in our work lives, we're interacting with these kinds of platform businesses all the time. One of the reasons I suspect we're here is that there are a number of very prominent multi-sided platforms around the world. If you take a look at the 10 largest companies in the world, publicly traded companies in the world, by market cap, seven of them derive a significant portion of their revenue from operating one or more platforms. On the right-hand side, there are examples of some of the platforms that they operate. So these are very common part of the economy in our lives these days. It's not a new business model, as Commissioner Chopra mentioned. It goes back millennia. There are these kind of businesses all over the place. What is new is starting around 2000, economists developed an interesting economic literature that studies these kind of businesses and offers a variety of insights. Listed there are some of the foundational theoretical papers, and we'll obviously be discussing much more of that today. So what I want to do first is to do a deep dive into how these businesses operate, elaborating on some of the remarks that you've already heard. So these platforms tend to emerge when there's an opportunity to solve a friction between partners. I have a tendency to call them trading partners. That may not be all that intuitive, but it's basically when there are a couple of economic agents for which there's a value-increasing opportunity for an exchange or other kind of interaction. So here are a bunch of examples of situations where frictions are reduced. So we just went through one where you have drivers with spare capacity in their cars and passengers looking for a ride. You have the situation where marketers would like to pay to deliver a message to me, an advertisement to me, and they're willing to pay more than I'm willing to pay to avoid it. So there's an opportunity for an exchange there and possibly some frictions in between. Men and women or other opposites would like to get together for romance, frictions possibly in that market. Buyers and sellers would like to get together in order to buy and sell things, but they need a common method of payment and need to agree on what that is, and there's a value to agreeing on something that's common. Now, what platforms do is they reduce transactions costs and they internalize externalities for those kinds of situations. So they do that in a couple of ways. First of all, they bring these parties together onto a common platform, and that solves, in effect, a collective action problem. And then once they've gathered these groups of different kinds of people or businesses or generally economic agents, they have ways to get them together in order for them to find good matches. So they reduce transactions costs by having matching mechanisms and other things that are basically designed to make the interaction possible, to make the exchange possible, and for it to be consummated. Now, there are a bunch of externalities that we ought to think about for these kinds of businesses, and I think Commissioner Chopra actually gave a good rendition of pretty much all of them. But let me elaborate a little bit more using economic language. So we have positive indirect network externalities. So that's the very basic thing that we always focus on when we talk about multi-sided platforms. Drivers value the platform more if they can get access to more passengers, because that makes it more likely they'll be able to fill up their car. Passengers like a platform more if they can get access to more drivers, because it's more likely that they'll be able to find a driver who they like, who's driving to the destination that they want to go in. So we have that classic positive indirect network externality. And as you saw in the case of BlaBlaCar, you need to have a density of drivers and passengers who are right for each other, in a sense. I think Catherine is going to talk more about that in detail. There are also negative externalities. So, for example, in the case of the car sharing platform, I really don't want strangers sitting in my car. So there's a negative externality from that, so we need to deal with that. Ad load on advertising media-supported sites is an example of an arguable negative externality. There's congestion on these platforms that needs to be dealt with. And then finally, and I particularly like the fact that Commissioner Chopra emphasized this, there are behavioral externalities on these platforms. Whenever you put together a community of people, just people, whenever you put together a community of people and businesses, they can do bad stuff to each other. And we'll see in a minute that one of the consequences of that is, in fact, rules and regulations. But there's the traditional problems that we always have in trade, so there can be fraud and deception and that standard list of problems. There's the gross stuff that can happen on platforms. And then there's the really bad stuff, including verbal and physical violence that takes place. Those are all things that we have whenever we have a community, and they potentially need to be dealt with on platforms. Managing those kinds of externalities and the full gamut of them, from indirect network externalities to negative externalities to behavioral externalities, those are really central to what platforms do and distinguish them from traditional businesses. So one way platforms address these kinds of externalities is through pricing and other aspects of the terms of trade. So like Catherine, I'm from Boston. I don't know why I have all these European examples, but I happen to be working on something in Germany, so I have Der Spiegel instead of Vogue. But, you know, it's basically the same story for any ad-supported magazine. Der Spiegel uses pricing to determine how many readers they can offer the advertising side of the platform, also use the ad load to kind of balance that terms of trade between the advertisers and the readers. And then they use platforms generally use non-pecuniary methods. In the case of Der Spiegel, this turns out to be the content. And the content in this particular case serves a couple of purposes. It serves the purpose of, in effect, paying the readers to come onto the magazine in order to get themselves exposed to the advertisements. But the other thing that it's doing is it's serving as a matching device. So I don't read German, but I will take the word of the Spiegel group, which says that the content in that magazine, for whatever reason, attracts male-educated readers with high income, and of course, German. So that's one thing that is done to address externalities. The other thing that's done to address externalities on multi-sided platforms is all aspects of how these platforms are designed, how they're physically designed, and the tools and techniques that are embedded in the platform. And just in a very simple sense, the next time you go to a shopping mall, you know, try to think through the logic of why stores are located in particular places, why the particular stores are there, why the mall is designed in a particular way. Same thing when you go on to a search results page for Google or Bing or whatever. There's a logic to how that's designed, and it's designed in a way to deal with these kinds of externalities. And then finally, rules and governance. So one of the things that characterizes many, not all, but many multi-sided platforms is that there are behavioral rules for interactions. There are do's and don'ts of being on the platform. And that generally means that there are rules, there are detection mechanisms, and there's enforcement mechanisms. So here's an example for the App Store, for the iPhone. Not everyone can get an app populated in the App Store. There are rules for that. So you have to go through a vetting process to get into the App Store. And if you violate the rules once you're in the App Store, Apple can not only decide not to let you into the App Store in the first place, but they can also kick you out of the App Store. And that's a whole set of rules and a whole set of people working for Apple that are working on enforcing exactly that kind of set of rules and regulations. So let's put all that together for BlaBlaCar. So BlaBlaCar needs to have enough passengers for the drivers and enough drivers for the passengers. But in the case of the drivers, it has to compensate the drivers in order to get the drivers to have strangers sitting in their car. It adopted that peculiar pricing mechanism that I mentioned. They could have a pricing mechanism that offers higher compensation in order to attract more drivers, but they decided that they didn't want to be a platform where there were professional drivers working on the platform because that has other externalities for the community. So they adopted a mechanism where the drivers just get, in effect, gas money. The platform deals with negative externalities, in effect, works on making sure that there are good exchanges between the two sides through a variety of mechanisms. So the name BlaBlaCar comes from one of the ways they do that. So when you sign up for BlaBlaCar, you have to rate yourself as blah, 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 or blah, 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 which is an indicator of how chatty you like to be. Now, in my case, I like to have the shush option, which is not available on BlaBlaCar, which suggests that this is not a platform that is sufficiently differentiated for me. They also have ladies only, a great way for women to feel even safer, which is an option they developed particularly for women that were new to the platform, just to make it a safe experience. As a result of doing all those things and lots of other things, they've been successful at getting enough drivers and enough passengers between different city pairs in a number of countries in the world that they've entered. They're now in 22 countries and most of the European countries. They've entered into India as well, not in the U.S. For various reasons, not in a bunch of other countries, but very successful and where they've chosen to be. So those are some aspects of kind of the business reality of two-sided platforms. What I want to turn to now is to talk a little bit about the kind of the basic economics of these kinds of businesses. So platforms connect two groups with indirect network effects, and they do that to reduce transaction costs and to facilitate exchange. So the platform operates as an intermediary between two sides. It does that in order to facilitate good exchanges or good interactions, and to basically reduce transactions costs between those two groups. Typically, always, they have indirect network externalities. So to be a two-sided platform, it's always going to be the case that one side values having more of the other side. Doesn't have to be for both sides, but at least one side values having more of the other side. And what the platform does is it facilitates those groups getting together, and as a result of doing that, is able to release the value of exchange. So that can, depending upon how things are distributed, make both parties better off as a result of that. And then as a result of releasing the gains to trade, the platform gets to share in a portion of that, and that's how it gets compensated. What I just described leads to the interdependence of demand between the two sides of the platform. So the standard models, and by that I mean the three main ones that I mentioned in the earlier slide, the ones in the original Roche and Tyrol papers that kind of really kicked this field off, the Mark Armstrong paper from 2006, and Glenn Weil's paper that synthesizes those published in 2010 in the American Economic Review. Those all basically have models where there is interdependent demand that is developed in different ways under different different assumptions. What I've put out there is the basic equation in Mark Armstrong's model, and what you see there is you see a demand function, D1 and D2, and what you see as arguments of the demand function is the demand or the quantity of use by the other side of the platform. So that's the interdependence that's introduced in the Armstrong model, and as we'll see, that has some important implications. When you do profit maximization, given that interdependent demand, when you, the platform, does profit maximization, you have to determine the two prices, and in effect, what that means is you have to determine the pricing level for each one, how high or low are the level of prices going to be, but also, in effect, you determine the relative amounts of those prices. So there's a notion of pricing level, but there's also a notion of pricing structure, because in order to cover the cost of the platform, you can make a decision on do I want to recover more of the cost from this side, less of the cost from this side, or vice versa, and that's part of the calculus that goes into profit maximization. That all has significant implications for the economics of these businesses. It leads to a positive feedback loop between the two sides that relates both demand and the pricing decisions on both sides. And it has a bunch of other interesting implications as well. So we have different models, different theoretical models, but they lead to pretty much the same place as a general matter. And the interesting thing when you solve out those models is that it turns out that it can be, doesn't have to be, but it can be profit maximizing to set prices on one side that is less than marginal cost. And this is the whole notion that one side, in effect, is going to be a subsidy side, and the other side is going to be a money side. so that less than marginal cost could manifest itself in, it could be prices of zero, so in other words, it is free. It could be prices less than zero, in which case there could be rewards. So that's what's true in theory. What is interesting in this area, and what got people really excited back in the early 2000s, is that this isn't just a sort of a sport, you know, an unusual case like razor and blades that you can give your students. Rather, when you actually take a look at these businesses that we characterize as two-sided platforms, we discover that that pricing result is not just true in theory, but that it's true in practice. So that for a lot of platforms, it turns out that prices are less than marginal cost. That's generally true for newspapers, print magazines, and so forth. It's common, obviously, for free to be the model for these businesses. That's most online media, and it's not uncommon to have rewards. So if you use OpenTable, you get rewards for using restaurants, but you don't have to pay any fee. If you use credit cards, of course, you get rewards. In the discussion so far, I've talked about two-sided platforms. Just to record this, platforms can have more than two sides. Facebook has several sides. Google has three sides. Google Search has three sides, and so forth. But we tend to talk about two sides just to make things a little bit simpler. So that's a key result of the economics of two-sided platform. But there's more. So one of the other implications of the theory of two-sided platforms is it turns out the critical mass and the chicken and egg problem turn out to be very important for these kinds of businesses. And generally, if you want to operate one of these platforms, in order to deliver value to one side, you have to have the other side on board. And in order to deliver value to that side, you have to have the other side on board. So in order to really generate value, you need to have enough of both sides and in the right proportion. And we saw that in the case of BlaBlaCar. They had a lot of difficulty in the early years to get the platform off the ground because there just weren't enough drivers and passengers on particular city pairs. It was only once they were able to kind of move the demand for both groups up that they really had enough to get the thing off the ground. And that turns out to be a big challenge for these kinds of businesses. There is often, but not always, a chicken and egg problem in the sense that the only way you can solve that problem is to kind of figure out a way of getting both of them on board at more or less the same time. But there's this process of getting both on board that can be difficult. Now, this notion of critical mass, I mean, that certainly isn't original to two-sided platforms. There's a lot of interesting work in the older literature on indirect network effects that deals with critical mass. What is new and different with two-sided platforms is a recognition that that critical mass problem and the pricing results that I just mentioned cover a wide and surprising class of businesses. So, I mean, the insight is, well, yes, this covers the Windows operating system, but, oh, gee, surprisingly, it covers shopping malls as well as the local farmers market and so forth. I'm not going to say much about multi-homing. We should probably talk more about that in the session. I know there are going to be some questions on that. But one of the interesting things that turns out to be important in the theoretical literature for multi-sided platforms is the importance of whether consumers on either side tend to use one platform, so they standardize on one, or for whatever reason they're able to use multiple platforms. So most of us multi-home on credit cards. We have several in our wallet. Most merchants take several credit cards. Things get a little bit complicated when we start thinking about what the consumer does at the store. And at that point in time, the consumer is sort of single homing because they're pulling one card out. But there are some interesting implications from the extent to which there's single homing and multi-homing. If there's just single homing, then the only way that I, on the other side of the platform, can get access to those customers is through your platform, because those customers are only single homing on your platform, and that has some competitive implications that tend to really depend upon the facts of the business and business reality. Particularly after Amex, there's this great interest in defining two-sided platforms very, very precisely. I'm not sure that's necessarily the best use of intellectual energy, but we can talk about that. But let me give you what I think are the key components of the definition that tend to be used in practice in the papers. So you have two distinct types of customers for whom a value-increasing interaction is possible. There are frictions, breakdown of the Coase theorem, that makes those interactions difficult to arrange. The platform facilitates connections between those two distinct kinds of customers. And then participation by members of at least one group, this is the indirect network effects flowing in at least one direction, exists, so that there's a gained aggregating customers onto a single platform. I think in practice, for economists working on this area, it generally comes down to whether a business is connecting two different types of customers and for which there are sufficiently strong indirect network effects. Let me give a couple of pointers in terms of the scope of two-sided platforms. So ad-supported media are two-sided platforms. Advertisers on one side, users on the other side. This is the second friction externality that I mentioned in one of the early slides. The modern literature on ad-supported media since about the mid-2000s treats ad-supported media as two-sided platforms. So the classic paper in that area is Anderson and Gipsavich. And there are tons of really great empirical papers that use the two-sided framework for ad-supported media. It turns out that it's particularly easy in ad-supported media to get data on both sides. So there are very interesting papers, including some very nice ones using structural models for newspapers and radio in particular. Another point to just kind of keep in mind is that the members of the two groups have to be different for the purpose of the transaction or the purpose of the interaction that the platform is facilitating, but they could be the same economic agents. So if you think about something like Venmo, which is a P2P money transfer platform, people use that platform, but for any particular transaction, there's a sender and there's a receiver of funds. So the important thing is that for the transaction, there are differences and the demands are different, but they can be the same people. I guess another good example of that is eBay. People can buy stuff on eBay. They can sell stuff on eBay for a particular transaction. They're one or the other. One of the early definitions proposed by Roche and Tirole, I think in the 2006 paper, is that a defining characteristic of a two-sided platform is that the pricing structure can be manipulated in such a way to increase output. I think actually that once there are indirect network effects and excluding the possibility of arbitrage between the two sides, that's an implication of indirect network effects, so that we would expect that price-output relationship to be an implication of being a two-sided platform rather than being a defining characteristic. And I mention that because this actually came up in Justice Breyer's dissent in American Express. Having said that, as a practical matter, if I'm looking at businesses and trying to figure out whether they're two-sided platforms, I would take a look at whether the price structure matters. I would also take a look at whether there is a critical mass and chicken and egg problem and starting the platform, because those are all kind of clues as to whether you have this kind of multi-sided sidedness. Two-sided platforms aren't just complements, and everything is in a two-sided platform. I've said it. So let me cover the first of those. So in terms of complements, and I mention this because this is a this is an argument that one sometimes gets. So if we think about complements in general, usually complements are being sold to the same customer, for example, gasoline and tires, nuts and bolts, and so forth, while the platform, two-sided platforms are generally serving two different kinds of customers, at least for the purpose of that interaction. Complements can be sold by different firms. So some firms sell gas, some firms sell tires, some firms do sell both. In the case of platforms, if you want to operate a platform and you want to internalize these externalities, you have to have both groups of customers on the same platform, and you need to be serving both of them at the same time. The theory doesn't say that every business is two-sided, and it doesn't even say that every intermediary is two-sided. So many traditional businesses don't connect two sides. That's also true for some intermediaries. Many traditional businesses lack significant indirect network effects. Then the final point to just be made there is the two-sided theory has predictions on business behavior that are really interesting, that apply to these firms that we think of as two-sided platforms, but don't apply to traditional firms. The final example there is what BlaBlaCar does. What does BlaBlaCar do? Well, it sells drivers access to passengers, and it sells passengers access to drivers, and basically it's selling both of them connections to each other. So multi-sided platforms aren't everything, but having said that, they are increasingly common. And they're increasingly common because we've had this incredible technological change, including the internet, but including lots of other stuff, that has made it much more easy to start a platform business, to not only start that business, but to scale that business on a global basis. One of the things I think is true for an awful lot of the multi-sided platforms that we see, including many of the successful ones, is they're replacing other multi-sided platforms that were operating in a more fragmented way using older technology. But these platforms are definitely increasingly common, which I suspect is why we're having these hearings and why there is so much interest in this topic basically around the world. So I'd like to conclude. I'm told that I can conclude by having an advertisement. So if you want to learn more, Matchmakers is now available in multiple formats and in multiple languages. I think the French win the award for the most boring title. I think the Koreans won the award for the nicest cover. But in any case, if you want to learn more about multi-sided platforms, take a look at my book with Dick Schmalensee, Matchmakers.